From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Bob Newhart. His debut comedy album, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, was released in 1960 and became the first comedy album to hit number one on the charts. It also made him a star. Newhart's classic comedy routines have been reissued on a Newhart anthology. We'll talk with him about his classic comedy routines and his popular TV sitcoms. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Blow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Bush is applauding the Senate for passing a big tax cut, even though it's only three-quarters as large as he would have liked. By a vote of 65 to 35, the Senate approved a modified budget plan today. It includes a $1.2 trillion tax cut. The president wanted $1.6 trillion, but he says the Senate action shows Congress is well on the way to real, meaningful tax relief. Administration officials say they hope the U.S. Navy flyers being detained in China will be released soon, but they're less confident that China will return the plane, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
U.S. defense officials assume that Chinese authorities are carefully going through the U.S. EP-3 surveillance plane that landed at a Chinese airfield last weekend. The aircraft carried highly sophisticated technology. By studying it, the Chinese theoretically could learn how the United States is able to monitor other countries' communications, including electronic signals. But in practice, that might be difficult. If the U.S. crew members were able to erase data and encryption codes and destroy software, Chinese engineers may have a hard time making sense of the hardware remaining on board the plane. Still, the Chinese are considered experts at what's called reverse engineering, taking a finished product apart and figuring out how to make copies of the equipment. For that reason, U.S. officials say they expect the Chinese will be reluctant to return the surveillance technology. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
The Education Department has released the latest reading scores for American fourth graders, and NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports the results are disappointing.
Of the 8,000 public and private school students who took the government's one-hour test last year, 37% did not do very well. They had trouble locating and identifying facts from the kinds of stories and articles that they're likely to come across in children's books and magazines. 27% of white students read poorly. Among blacks, 63% and 58% of Latinos struggled. The poorest readers are male. Most live in poverty. They attend large urban schools and watch a lot of television. Girls outperform boys, and private school students did better than public school students. Average reading scores for white and black students have remained virtually unchanged since 1992. They're somewhat worse for Latinos. The smallest of the groups, American Indians, suffered the biggest drop in performance, while Asian fourth graders posted the biggest gains of any group. I'm Claudia Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
California's biggest utility has filed for bankruptcy. PG&E says it's been caught in the vise between rising wholesale power costs and the California law forbidding utilities from passing those costs on to consumers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down by 127 points today. They ended the day at 97.91. The Nasdaq Composite lost 64 points to finish at 17.20. The S&P 500 was down 23. This is NPR. The Federal Communications Commission has issued specific guidelines to tell broadcasters how to avoid indecent programming. The guidelines outline what not to say or even to suggest, and they contain specific examples to help broadcasters stay within the law. The FCC says the guidelines will also help viewers and listeners who want to file complaints. A Texas jury has awarded $56.5 million to a woman who had sued American Home Products Corporation. The company made the diet drugs known as Fen-Phen, which were tied to heart damage. Bill Siebel of member station KERA reports.
Gloria Lopez says her heart damage was caused by the mix of fenfluramine or dexfenfluramine with an amphetamine-like drug. That combination made up Fen-Phen and resulted in heart valve damage to Lopez and many other users. In turn, American Home Products withdrew both its fenfluramine products in 1997. The giant drug and healthcare products maker then reached a national class action settlement with thousands of its pharmaceutical users who said they had not been adequately warned about the drug risks. $12.5 billion were set aside last year to handle the settlement, but some clients, like Lopez, preferred individual suits instead of the settlement. The company says it's disappointed by the jury's decision and will seek a reduction in the award amount in the short term and reversal of the award in the long term on appeal. For NPR News, I'm Bill Ziebel in Dallas.
A Nebraska man has been ordered to undergo a competency evaluation after whacking the Liberty Bell with a hammer today. Philadelphia police arrested the man and say they'll charge him with destroying federal property, but they say the damage to the historic bell is apparently superficial. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. On the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Folly, a novel by Laurie R. King, the author of A Darker Place.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Newhart's early comedy recordings are collected on a new double CD called Something Like This, the Bob Newhart Anthology. He was honored at this year's U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen. With the help of Nick at Night, several generations have become Newhart fans. He played psychologist Dr. Bob Hartley on The Bob Newhart Show, which had its initial run from 1972 to 78. From 1982 to 90, he starred in the sitcom Newhart as Vermont innkeeper Dick Loudon. Newhart just signed to co-star with MTV rap star Sisqó in the pilot for an NBC series. On this archive edition, we have a 1998 interview with Bob Newhart. First, let's listen to a track from the Newhart anthology. This was originally featured on his first comedy album, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, which was recorded in 1960 and became the first comedy album to hit number one on the charts. This routine is an example of the one-sided phone conversation that became a Newhart trademark. The premise is, what if Abe Lincoln was getting advice from a Madison Avenue PR executive?
Listen, Abe, I got to know it. What's the problem? You're thinking of shaving it off. Abe, don't you see that's part of the image? Right, with the shawl and the stovepipe at the string tie. You don't have the shawl. Where's the shawl, Abe? You left it in Washington. What are you wearing, Abe? A sort of cardigan? Abe, don't you see that doesn't fit with the string tie and the beard? Abe, would you leave the beard on and get the shawl, huh? All right, now what's this about Grant? You're getting a lot of complaints on Grant's drinking, huh? Abe, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't see the problem. I mean, you knew he was a lush when you pointed him, you see that? You're gag writers. Yeah, you're gag writers. You want to come back with something funny, huh? Maybe an anecdote about a town drunk. Well, I can't promise anything, Abe. I'll get them working on it. All right, Abe, you got the speech. Abe, you haven't changed the speech, have you? Abe, what do you change the speeches for? A couple minor changes, I'll bet. All right, what are they? You what? You typed it. Abe, how many times have we told you on the backs of envelopes? I understand it's harder to read that way, Abe, but it looks like you wrote it on the train coming down or something like that. Abe, could you do this? Could you memorize it and then put it on the backs of the envelopes? We're getting a lot of play in the press on that. How are the envelopes holding up? You can stand another box. All right. Okay.
Now, how did you come up with the one-sided phone call bit?
Well, you know, I'm credited with that, and I certainly didn't invent the form. One of the first records ever was a thing called Cohen on the Telephone, And then, of course, George Jessel used to do phone calls to his mother, and then Shelley Berman did a lot of one-sided conversations. Mike and Lane did two-sided conversations, but they were telephone conversations. There are some routines that lend themselves to the telephone, and I think what happens is the audience, the people listening to it, it makes it a hot medium in Marshall McLuhan's words, because they're involved. They're supplying something. They're not just sitting back and saying, oh, that's funny. They're supplying the other end of the conversation. I belong to a country club out here, and George Scott belongs to it. And he asked me one time, he said, in that kind of gruff voice of his, he said, let me ask you something. How do you do those... How do you do those telephone conversations? And I said, well, George, I just, I ask a question, and then I wait long enough for the person on the other end to answer it, and then I start talking again. He said, that's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And I thought to myself, no, George, Patton is amazing. this is just a telephone conversation. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to do it. That's the only way you can do it.
Bob Newhart is my guest. Now, you're Catholic, and when you were coming of age as a comic, I think a lot of the comics were Jewish comics who were getting their start in the Catskill Mountains, which was a largely Jewish resort area. And I'm wondering if you ever felt that ethnic comics had a built-in constituency, i.e. people of their ethnic group. And did you feel like you had that kind of, you know, because there was no borscht belt for you.
No.
Did you play the borscht belt at all?
No, I never have.
Right.
The Catskills, no.
Right. So did you feel like that...
I played the Poconos. That's as close as I ever came to the Catskills.
Right. Okay. Did you feel like you were missing out on something, not being identified as an ethnic comic?
Well, you know, humor, I think, at that time was very regional. As I recall, it was I remember Phil Foster doing routines about the Brooklyn Dodgers. And then television came along, and you had to make your humor continental. You couldn't make it regional anymore. It had to be, you had to find ways of not making it regional, is what I'm trying to say. After some time, I realized that a lot of my friends, a lot of the comics are Jewish that I know, and they would refer to their Jewishness, and then I began referring to my Catholicism and what it's like to grow up as a Catholic, and began to realize how funny it is in many ways to grow up. It gives you a chance to kind of stand back and look at it. And find the humor in it.
What did you find funny about your Catholic upbringing?
Well, for instance, I said what the difference between Catholics and other religions is basically we have confession, and non-Catholics don't understand how you go in this little dark room and tell another human being like terrible things you've done during the week. But if you're raised Catholic, There are certain tricks you learn about going to confession, like you sit in the very last pew and you watch the two lines move into the confessional, and whichever line moves the fastest, that's the one you get in, because that priest wants to get out of there. And I remember the first time I did that, and it got a big reaction from the audience, and I realized, oh, I'm not the only one who did that.
You kind of treat it as if it was a long line at the supermarket instead of the confessional. Can you remember for us what the venues?
You know, yes. That's interesting, because it does suggest they might have a confessional like, you know, 10 sins or less. You know.
The swift moving line.
I just thought of that.
That's good. Oh, can you recall for us what your early venues were like? What the smaller clubs, if there were such things at the time, and you know what Reno and Vegas were like when you started doing them in the 60s?
Oh, wow. There were clubs. They weren't comedy clubs per se, much as they'd be referred to today as, with just one comic after another getting up and doing 5 minutes. There was they were folk music clubs, places like Mr. Kelly's in Chicago and the Hungry Eye in San Francisco and the Crescendo in Los Angeles, and you'd get up and do half hour. 35 minutes, and then this folk group would come on and sing, and then a guy would play the banjo and do protest songs, and then you'd be on again.
And what about Vegas?
Vegas was fun. It was a chance to you'd be there for a month. So it was a chance for the family to come up and be with you on the weekends and have some kind of normalcy to your life. As much as walking on a stage twice a night and trying to make people laugh is normal, you know. But that would be the... And there was a camaraderie among Vegas people that still exists. I still see Steve and Edie and Shecky Green and Dick Martin and Don Rickles and these are all friendships that were developed in Vegas.
Well, you know, you mentioned Don Rickles. I know you and he are, or at least were, best friends. And it seems like such an incongruous pairing because, you know, I mean, the last thing in the world you would do is insult people on stage. And Don Rickles is like Mr. Insult Comic. Your temperaments couldn't seem more opposite.
Well, I don't know.
Are you really nasty off the stage? And is he really nice?
Oh, he's very nice. Yeah, I'm probably nastier off the stage than I appear, and he's nicer than he appears. Mm-hmm. But we feed each other. We both our wives enjoy each other's company, and we enjoy each other's company. And we go away on vacation, and we're together for 2 or 3 weeks, and we have laughs. We just have a good time. It's something I wish everybody could have. A friend such as the Rickles.
Where do you guys go on vacation? Not to Vegas.
Oh, no. That'd be a working vacation.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be a, what they call it, busman's holiday. The last trip we made, we went to Southeast Asia. We went to, we flew to Singapore and got aboard a liner and, made stops in Bangkok and South Vietnam and North Vietnam and then Hong Kong, and then we flew to Beijing in China and then flew home from Beijing. And it was a wonderful, wonderful trip. It was we went up the Saigon River, and it's very narrow at points, and they have a pilot who was a local Vietnamese who knows the river very well, and we happen to be up in the where you know with the captain invited us up, and this Vietnamese was yelling out, barking out, 2 degree right, 4 degree right, 2 degree right, 2 degree left, 4 degree, that kind of thing, and because at times you could almost hit the bottom of the Saigon River because it was such a large cruise ship. And the captain said, "You see that man who's the pilot?" I said, "Yes." He said, "He's the third most highly decorated Viet Cong in Vietnam." And that was weird. That was a weird sensation of. It was approximately, I think it was just about 20 years, almost to the day that the Vietnamese War ended. It was chilling.
You know, I'm wondering, I'm thinking like how odd it would have been if, like, say I were a journalist in Vietnam and there was Don Rickles and Bob Newhart sailing up the river. I thought I was hallucinating or something. Did you run into any people who did a real double take, seeing you and he would go by?
Met a man. It's maybe, I'm confused now whether it was China or Vietnam. But anyway, they kind of knew who I was, but they didn't know who Don was. And I think that upset him. And I derived a great deal of satisfaction from it. But that has happened before. We traveled in Europe, and of course they don't really know either of us. And they certainly don't know what to make of Don. Here's this loud American who's just yelling things at people and insulting them. And
well, does he do that when he's touring?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, sure. And so they don't quite know what to make of Don when we're on vacation.
I mean, does he do that as shtick, or is that just the way he treats people?
He can't help it. He sees things, and he makes observations that are just... they're scary at times, that they're so they're so right, you know?
We're listening to a 1998 interview with Bob Newhart. The new CD, the Bob Newhart Anthology, collects his classic comedy recordings. We'll hear more from Newhart after a break. This is Fresh Air. Fridays on Fresh Air, we feature interviews from our archive with writers, filmmakers, actors, and musicians who have just released new work. Our archive is filled with some of the most interesting people in entertainment, literature, and the arts. We thank you for supporting us and enabling us to slowly put together this archive. Now it's time to ask again for your support. Your pledge will help us produce new shows and help enlarge our archive of American culture, which means more good listening. Thank you again for your support. My guest is Bob Newhart. I have another question about when you started doing stand-up comedy. You started doing stand-up during the era I've come to think of as the "you dirty rat" era, because every stand-up comic was compelled to do impersonations of James Cagney, and they also were required to do impersonations of Armstrong and Bogart, and you did some of those yourself.
I was never much of a impersonator. Comics kind of have an ear for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never real good at it. What I found what was interesting, and it certainly wasn't planned in any way, but the people I mentioned, Mike and Elaine and Shelley Byrne and myself and Johnny Winters and Lenny Bruce, it was a different kind of comedy than had preceded it. What had preceded it was material that could be stolen. In other words, "Take My Wife, Please."
Jokes.
Or jokes. I burned a hole in the coat. I you like this jacket? It's a beautiful jacket. I got 8 pairs of pants with it. With my luck, I'll burn a hole in the coat. You know, well, anybody could deliver that line. It wasn't personalized at all, but. Without realizing it, because I certainly wasn't aware of it. It's only in hindsight that I'm aware of it. You couldn't steal a Mike and Elaine routine or a Shelley Berman routine or a Bob Newhart routine or Johnny Winters routine. They would say, "Oh, that sounds like Johnny Winters." And so it became, it was just shift in American comedy that just happened. And I think why it happened was our audience was largely college kids, and they didn't have mother-in-laws, so mother-in-law jokes didn't mean anything to
them.
Thank
goodness.
You know? and so to that extent, the humor that was being done in nightclubs was irrelevant to them, and it was also very expensive. Nightclubs had a cover charge, and it was very expensive to go to a nightclub, and they didn't have the money, obviously. So they would buy a record, and get some pizza and some beer, and they'd all sit around and listen to one of us, and that was their nightclub. And I think that's what happened.
Bob Newhart is my guest. Let me ask you about the first sitcom that you did, the first Newhart show. You played a psychiatrist. It's common now to have stand-up comics with their own sitcoms. In fact, it's almost obligatory. right. What was it like when you were a stand-up comic, having a sitcom built around you?
Well, it was paternalistic, really, because my manager, and my manager still is Arthur Price, and he and Mary Tyler Moore and Grant Tinker formed MTM Productions. And with the success of Mary's show, he came to me and he said, would you like to do a sitcom? And I said, yeah, I would, because it would keep me home, it keep me off the road, and I could spend some time with the family, which was very important. So we then went about trying to come up with a sitcom. We started out with what occupation is he? First of all, he's married, right? Okay, he's married, and I insisted on that we not have children, that we not have precocious children, because I hated that those kind of shows that where the kids are always bailing the dumb father out of some scrape he's gotten himself into, you know, and we love you, Daddy. Daddy's an idiot, but we do love you. And resolved I wasn't going to do that kind of show. And so then we started looking for occupations, and sat down with Lorenzo Music and Dave Davis, who I'd worked with before, who had been writers on the Mary Tyler Moore show, and I knew Lorenzo from the Smothers Brothers show. And he said, well, you know, Bob is, he's a listener. He's like a reactor. He reacts to people. What occupation would lend itself to somebody who listens? And they said, well, how about a psychiatrist? So they came to me and said, what about a psychiatrist? I said, well, let's make him a psychologist, because I think a psychologist tends to deal with less severely disturbed people, and I didn't want to be making fun of severely disturbed people. I didn't want to be making fun of people with multiple personalities or schizophrenia or any
right.
of that stuff.
Suicidal depression, yes. Yeah. Right. Mr. Carlin.
Mr. Carlin actually was worse at the end of 6 years than he was when he originally came to me. So he has a class action suit against me, I think, as do most of my group.
Bob Newhart recorded in 1998. His classic comedy recordings are collected on the new double CD, Something Like This, the Bob Newhart Anthology. More Newhart in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hello?
Coming up, straight-laced, middle-of-the-road, kind of dull guy comedy. We talk with Bob Newhart about his sitcom characters. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, Blow.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Nonesuch Records and soprano Dawn Upshaw's release, Angels Hide Their Faces, featuring music of Bach and Purcell, available at Barnes & Noble music locations. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bob Newhart. His classic comedy routines from the 60s are collected on the new CD, Something Like This, the Bob Newhart Anthology. In the 70s, he played psychologist Bob Hartley on The Bob Newhart Show. Here's a scene in which Bob and his wife Emily, played by Suzanne Pleshette, have just found out their respective IQ scores.
You know, Bob, ever since you took that IQ test, you've been sitting around acting petulant.
What do you mean by that?
Petulant means suddenly irritated by the trivial.
Emily, I know what petulant means. You don't have to talk down to me just because I'm not as intelligent as you are.
Bob, you are intelligent.
Well, maybe I am, Emily, but ever since I found out what our IQs are, I think it's affecting our marriage.
What do you mean by that?
Marriage is a wedding between
two... Oh, Bob, I know what marriage means. What's it got to do with us? We've got a perfect marriage.
Emily, a perfect marriage is where the husband and the wife have the same IQ.
Bob, it is not important.
Next to perfect is where the husband's is higher than the wife.
Bob, forget it.
Third is where the wife is 1 point higher than the husband.
Please, Bob.
And the fourth, which is us, which is the worst, is where the wife is 151 and the husband is 129, which is a difference of,
22.
Let's get back to our interview with Bob Newhart. Now, part of your persona in the Newhart show was, you know, he was the straight-laced, middle-of-the-road guy who was kind of dull.
Okay.
Right? How did the writers come up with that aspect of it? A lot of surrounded by a lot of nutty, eccentric people, but he was kind of dull.
Well, part of the success of Newhart was we tried to isolate what made the Bob Newhart show work. And what seemed to make part of the Bob Newhart show, at least the working environment of the Bob Newhart show, the psychologist's office, was you had to have a situation where no matter how outrageous the statement was made by one of the patients, You couldn't react to it. You couldn't say, "That's the craziest thing I've ever heard, Mr. Carlin." You know, you'd have to say. I remember one time I said, "How did this week go?" He said, "It went very well." He said, "Oh, Saturday I was possessed by the devil," and I think my line was, "Okay, you want to go with that, Mr. Carlin?" You know, I couldn't say you were what. So we tried to find those elements in Newhart, and we found them in the guests. No matter how unreasonable the guests were, you still had to kind of say, "Certainly, sir, certainly, I'll send the maid up to the room right away."
Do you have a favorite episode from the first Newhart show?
I have several. There's one that kind of summed up comedy to me. I had a African-American insurance salesman came in, and he was very tall and muscular, and he wore the Djibouti, and he had a black Great Dane that he called Whitey, and he came to me, and he said, "I don't seem to be able to sell insurance policies," and I said, "Well, it has nothing to do with your personality. It's just that you kind of scare people, you know." And he said, "Well, thank you very much." So then we leave my office, and he said, "Is the men's room?" And I pointed out just down the hall, and within he let the Great Dane stay there. So with that, Jerry comes out, and he comes over to me, and we start talking. And with the black gentleman comes back in, and he says, "Sit, Whitey." And with that, Jerry sits right on the reception desk, you know. And it got a huge laugh. And to me, it summed up what comedy does. It diffuses tensions in many areas. It gives you distance so that you can stand back and laugh at things. But there were a lot of Bob Newhart shows and Newhart shows that I loved. I love one that Julia sang. We did a telethon and had nothing to do with me. I mean, I was the host of the telethon, but Julia...
this is on the Vermont show.
Yeah, Julia Duffy, Stephanie. Everybody was doing something on the telethon to try to raise money. I forget what the cause was. And Julia did an up-tempo Old Man River. And it's one of the funniest things to this day that I've ever seen. It was hysterical. It was, I mean, her lack of understanding of the lyrics was incredible.
Well, that was a great show, too, the show in which you played an innkeeper in Vermont, and who also, at least for several years, hosted a local TV show called
That's
Vermont
right.
Today, in which
right.
in which Michael, your producer, would either book you the most ludicrous or just incredibly boring guests.
That's
and
right.
I love the look on your face when you were interviewing somebody, just outrageously dull, you know, doing an outrageously pointless interview.
We had Estelle Getty on one show before the Golden Girls, and she was a librarian who had come up with a new Dewey Decimal System. and Michael was trying to jazz it up. He had all kinds of things going in the background to kind of jazz it up.
You know, your shows have been rerun a lot on Nick at Night, and I think there was one, I don't know, 24 or 48-hour period when they did a whole Bob-a-thon. They were bringing on, I guess, a new series of yours, a new and rerun series of yours, and to introduce it and celebrate it, there was just hour after hour of continuous Newhart programs. What was that like for you?
Well, that's a tribute to the cast and to the writing, that the writing is still valid. And I had something to do with that. I told the writers, don't put any Gerald Ford jokes, you know, because this is going to be rerun and rerun and rerun, and we're going to look silly, you know. Because I knew then that it would go into syndication and people would be watching it. And we tried to get away from being trendy, and
right.
for that reason. And it holds up. The material holds up, which is largely a tribute to the writing.
The lapels and the sideburns don't hold up.
That's the only thing I know.
You wear a lot of plaid also.
Oh yeah.
No, well, see, whose idea was all the plaid?
My dresser my dresser was colorblind.
Are you kidding?
Name was Ralph, yeah. And he was such a nice guy, we didn't want to say anything, but...
Oh, that's so Newhart.
My wife...
that is like quintessential Newhart.
My wife would come in, and I'd be ready to go out, and I'm not good with colors either, so she would say, oh, my God, you're kidding. And I said, what? She said, oh, take the jacket off. It doesn't even come close to going with the shirt.
That's funny.
But, you know, of all careers to choose when you're colorblind, I mean, wardrobe seems like the last one.
Yeah, you think somebody might have said something about it at the studio, or...
I remember reading an article in a paper about a one-eyed bullfighter in... again, we get back to material coming out of the papers. A one-eyed bullfighter in Spain who was reapplying for license to fight the bulls. And... it occurred to me then that if there is one occupation where you really want to have two good eyes, I think bullfighting would be right up toward the top, you know? I mean, of all professions to choose.
My guest is Bob Newhart. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with Bob Newhart.
When you started on television, it was in the days when there were three networks and in many cities a couple of, you know, syndicated kind of channels. But, you know, when a show was popular, everybody seemed to watch it. And television has just become such a different experience now because there's so many channels. Do you feel the difference?
Well, of course, we used to get shares like 42, 43 shares.
It's an enormous
I mean, you know,
amount of people.
Those are Super Bowl shares now.
Exactly.
Because there was no competition. I just found out the engineer told me that I was the I Love Lucy of the United Arab Emirates, which I had never known. He said, but they showed the Bob Newhart show in the United Arab Emirates, and people would go home early from work to see it. I never knew I was a hit in the Middle East.
Huh. The first Newhart show was on Saturday night, right after Mary Tyler Moore.
It was All in the Family, MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, us, and Carol Burnett.
Was Saturday night a good time? I remember, you know, like when I didn't have something to do, when I was feeling really bad about it. At least I could stay home and watch you and Mary Tyler Moore, so it wasn't a total loss.
Well, it was a time shift. People stayed home Saturday because of that lineup, as they stay home Thursday because of NBC's must-see Thursdays. And it used to be, I think Monday was Lucy, I think, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
I think Monday, and then I think Burl was Tuesday. And so it shifted. That was must-see Saturday.
When I think of the Newhart character in your shows from the 70s and the 80s, I think of somebody who stammers a lot, not because he's unsure of what he feels, but because he can't really afford to reveal what he really feels because it might be a little harsh or it might be a little too something. So there's this constant kind of like stammering to just, you know, cover up and to try to kind of package in a better way what it is that he's really thinking or feeling. Does that work for you?
Well, that's interesting because the stammer is real. I didn't invent the stammer. I remember in the first year of Newhart, we were doing an episode, and it was running long. And one of the producers came up to me and said, "Can you run some of the words together? Because the show is really spreading." And I said, look, this stammer got me a home in Beverly Hills, and I'm not about to change it, so you better cut some words out of the script. No, it isn't. It isn't an affectation. It's a way I speak, although I do I know what you're saying. It does help to get you over an uncomfortable moment. I think of him as a nice person who doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Right.
But at the same time, has difficulty saying, you know, what he means.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you,
Terry. Very much.
Bob Newhart recorded in 1998. There's a new anthology of his classic comedy recordings called Something Like This, the Bob Newhart Anthology. Here's the track, Bus Driver's School.
Here's the situation, Johnson. You've just pulled into a stop. You've discharged your passengers, and out of the rearview mirror, you notice this old woman running for the bus. Okay. You want to start running now, Mrs. Selkirk? Okay, let's see how Johnson goes about handling. Hold it, Johnson. You're pulling out much too fast, Johnson. See, she gave up about halfway in the block, you see. Yeah, what you want to do is just kind of gradually ease out, you see, so you're always holding out the hope they may be able to catch the bus. Oh, another thing you want to watch, a lot of these old women, they'll run at three-quarter speed, you see. Then they'll put on a final burst and they'll catch up with the bus, so. Graham, you want to be the bus driver? Yes, Mrs. Selkirk, you want to get back to your mark again? All right, let's try it with Graham. Same situation. All right, you want to start running again, Mrs. Selkirk? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see how Graham handles this situation. All right, fine. Did y'all see how he slammed the door right in her face that time? That's known as your perfect pullout.
Bob Newhart. The new movie Blow is about a drug dealer, but it has a different tone than the hit film Traffic, and it begins in a different era. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Hollywood has feasted on the rise and fall of criminal careers from the roaring 20s till today. Blow, directed in a cheery, breezy style by Ted Demme, brings a contemporary puckishness to this well-worn saga, this time focusing on George Young, a kid from a small town in Massachusetts who went from 60s pot dealer to 70s coke entrepreneur. Featuring Johnny Depp, as stoically eccentric as ever, as the movie's lovable anti-hero, the movie covers four decades of drug dealing. A lot of plot is disgorged in the process, but the movie's lickety-split style ensures that it all passes effortlessly. What does stick in the craw, though, is the movie's insistence that Young is the Ralph Cramden of drug dealers, a henpecked dreamer who tried too hard to please the women in his life. The depiction of Young, his unlikely cohorts, and the passing eras is so entertaining that you're willing to swallow the improbable claim that one single smuggler opened America's cocaine floodgates. Paul Rubens, of Pee Wee Herman fame, co-stars as a flamboyant California hairdresser who starts out as Young's pot financier and ends up riding the cocaine train to ridiculous riches. At one point, the business is going so well that the organization has a house full of cash it doesn't have any place to store. The sight of an imperturbable Depp wandering through roomfuls of plastic-wrapped cash becomes an instantly classic caricature of the American dream. But his Colombian partner's greed and the U.S. government's improved law enforcement increase the frequency and duration of Young's prison stays. Yet Young's pain doesn't begin with such manly interference. Blow would have us believe that Young has been suffering his entire life at the hands of women. The movie, which is narrated in flashback by Young, opens with a prelude in his Massachusetts hometown. There we meet his kindly dad, played by Ray Liotta, and his status-conscious, avaricious mom, Ermine. Played by Rachel Griffiths as a ferocious suburban Medea, Ermine is the kind of wife who leaves her husband when he hits financial bad times and the type of mom who drops a dime on her pot-dealing son. The implication is obvious. Not wanting to be spurned as a business failure the way his dad was, Young goes into the drug business to compensate. Then the money is used to buy his way into respectability. Ah, but then he merely repeats his dad's mistake, marrying a chic Colombian woman, Mirtha, played to no great effect by Penelope Cruz, who turns out to be his mom in disguise. In this scene, Young's mom and dad come visit his new mansion for a look-see at the ill-gotten gains. Mother and daughter-in-law immediately bond over the display of wealth.
Oh, God, it's enormous!
Like it.
Look. Look at this credenza.
Ah, no, es divino, es espectacular.
Oh, yes, what, it's Spanish? If you don't mind me asking, how much is one of these? It's gotta cost a fortune.
It's a family heirloom, Ma.
I've seen these in magazines, they don't come cheap.
Mirtha comes from a very wealthy family.
Oh.
Papi, do you like it?
Very nice.
Nice,
very nice, yeah.
Come on, I'll show you the rest of the house.
Oh, great. George mentioned a jacuzzi. I've always wanted a jacuzzi. Oh, and one of those bidets.
Cocktail.
Young's entanglements with undeserving women is a recurring dramatic motif that expands to a full-throated chorus in the movie's final 30 minutes. That's when Young's daughter Christina gets into the act. Despite being just a little girl, Christina turns out to be as demanding as her mother and grandmother. Just when a newly ruined Young needs her love the most, she spurns him. It seems like a reasonable response from a little kid whose daddy is in jail so often, but then she becomes an emotional blackmailer. Although Blow has its share of sharp comedic moments, its triple portrait of female witchery is intended seriously. Underneath the slick surface of daring drug escapades, the movie burbles with fear and anxiety over the insatiable appetites of women.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. This is Fresh Air. We hope our reviews and interviews have led you to movies, books, music, and TV shows that you've enjoyed, and that they've helped steer you away from things that aren't worth the time. Let me explain something about Fresh Air. Each station that carries Fresh Air has to pay a fee. That's the way it works with most NPR shows. The fee goes toward our production budget. So your station needs your pledge in order to continue carrying Fresh Air. I hope you'll call with a pledge. Thank you. In 1986, the rap act Run-DMC collaborated with the hard rock band Aerosmith on the song Walk This Way. It not only revitalized Aerosmith's then sagging career, but was also the first top 10 pop chart hit to include rap music. By coincidence, both Aerosmith and Run-DMC have new, separate CDs out. Aerosmith's is called Just Push Play, and Run-DMC's is Crown Royal. Rock critic Ken Tucker compares the two acts 15 years after their collaboration.
The title of Aerosmith's new hit single, Jaded, is romantically self-referential. It's sung to an old girlfriend, and in the chorus, singer Steven Tyler concludes, "You're so jaded, and I'm the one who jaded you," which means, I think, that you should substitute the word corrupted for jaded. From their start, Aerosmith has always traded on a decadent bad boy image. Me, I marvel at the way the band has managed to reposition itself as the grand old men of rock and roll. Since I'm old enough to remember when Aerosmith was considered the band you listened to while waiting for a new release from the real thing, the Rolling Stones. But what Aerosmith can still do, that the Stones no longer seem willing or able to do, is crank out a catchy chorus and some guilty pleasure power ballads like this one, Love Lies.
Oh, when you cross that line that you know you can't erase, to fall in lust, not love, ain't no sin at all. And tell me, when you're with your best friend's friend, do you still feel out of place? No thanks, I took that ride. God only knows I tried.
Where Aerosmith found a formula in the 90s and ran with it, Run-DMC, by contrast, came to a dead halt. Two of the three core members of the act took more spiritual paths. In fact, Daryl DMC McDaniels became a deacon in his church and pretty much dropped out of the Run-DMC business a decade ago. He chronicles his disillusionment with the music business and his religious awakening in a new book called King of Rock, Respect, Responsibility, and My Life with Run-DMC. And on this comeback CD, McDaniels and his partners are in a nostalgic mood, boasting about their old hits and breakthroughs, including their Aerosmith collaboration.
Got my collar on too. I got the rhyme and the beat and the vibe from the street and now the rest is on you.
The rest is on me, man. Let me let y'all know something. The first rap group to get on MTV, Hard Heavy, you heard me? And then they gonna turn around and resurrect Al Smith life, you know what I mean? Bring them back, you know what I'm saying? If it wasn't for these cats, man, y'all wouldn't know nothing about no LL Cool J or Beastie Boys, you know what I mean? And it's coming from me. I'm looking at it, man. Since I've been 13 years old, man, I've been watching these cats, man. I ain't no old, but I know, you heard me? You know what I'm saying? So stop all that front, man. Stop all your front, you heard me?
All is not nostalgia, however. The new Run-DMC disc Crown Royal tries to make these anti-gangster rappers sound up-to-date by inviting guest stars like Kid Rock, Fred Durst from Limp Bizkit, and the white hip-hopper Sugar Ray to join in. The results are very uneven, but occasionally fun, as on the jaunty Them Girls, which proves that Run-DMC still has a knack for a clever rhyme, a playful chorus, and a carnal attraction to the ladies.
Seen this girl on the block by the boondock. On the spot, she was down for the boondock. Drop top, she was rocking the Tupac. Said, yo, D, not me, what you got? D said, she's a vibrant bang, vibrant bang, vibrant bang. Seen a girl so crystal clean, I mean, since I've been on the scene, I dream of girls in Tupac. Who's on rooftops? Now this girl, who cools is the Tupac? Get this girl in my bathtub, give her a back rub. My bathroom's like a nightclub. A few ladies in my den, fondling. A few ladies in the den, to bring some jello in. And a mighty fine fellow in like myself, to organize the panties on the shelf. Them girls, I do adore.
I like a sweet and fine, a genuine divine, all kinds I love them all.
Them girls.
The truth is, both Aerosmith and Run-DMC have pretty much outlasted their usefulness in the pop marketplace. A younger new hard rock band like Buck Cherry makes Aerosmith sound winded and out of it, while a rapper such as Nas, who guest stars on Run-DMC's disc, is your go-to guy when you want precise wordplay and musical hooks these days. In 1986, it was exhilarating and important to hear white rockers work with mutual respect with black rappers. Today, the synthesis is complete. More white rappers who combine heavy guitar with spoken lyrics than you can shake an M&M at. And Aerosmith and Run-DMC can do little more than add respectable footnotes to their own small legends.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Our engineer today was Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a woman reporter behind the lines of the war in Chechnya. We talk with French journalist Anne Neva. After the Russians denied her press credentials to cover the war, she went anyways, disguising herself as a Chechen woman. She's written a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.